Welcome to Food, Nutrition, Culture, and Diabetes, a podcast series that explores culinary traditions, health beliefs, and practices with an emphasis on culturally competent diabetes counseling. Today's spotlight is on Mexico. Hello, my name is Lorena Drago. I'm a registered dietitian, certified diabetes educator, and the owner of Hispanic Foodways. Visit HispanicFoodways.com for nutrition and diabetes information in English and in Spanish. I would like to begin by saying that the American Diabetes Association estimates that about 8% or almost 24 million people of the population in the United States has diabetes. Unfortunately, the number is increasing steadily, especially within minorities, including Hispanics. The total prevalence of diabetes has increased almost 14% just from 2005 through 2007. And the impact of diabetes is staggering in terms of the comorbidities, such as heart disease and hypertension, and also the cost in terms of healthcare, economical, political, and social system. So here today to talk about Mexican culture, including food, nutrition, and especially counseling tips for those of you that have Mexican patients in your practice, is our invited guest, Eva Brzezinski. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you very much.
Good. I am delighted to have Eva with us today. And let me give you a little bit of information. Eva is a native of Mexico City and a registered dietitian with a Master's of Science degree in nutrition from San Diego State University. Eva has an interest in diabetes management. She works at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. And at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego, she works with bariatric patients both before and after the surgery. And I think that that's so important, especially after the surgery. And she also works with in the cardiac floor, and she also is a pediatric dietitian. And I am glad to say that Eva is also an author, and together with Dr. Kathleen Briggs Early, wrote a chapter for the American Dietetic Association Cultural Food Practices and Diabetes book, which will be available in 2009. So let me welcome you again, Eva.
Thank you so very much.
And let's start talking about the Mexican culture.
Sure.
One thing that I think probably most listeners will probably agree is that Hispanics represent the largest minority population in the United States. And that's almost about 24% of the U.S. population by 2050. And also that Mexicans are the largest Hispanic group, comprising almost about 67% of the United States Hispanic population. But unfortunately, when it comes to diabetes, Mexican-American adults are twice more likely than non-Hispanic white adults to have been diagnosed with diabetes by a physician. So most likely there are many Mexicans that have not been diagnosed with diabetes. Now, where in the United States do we find the largest concentration of Mexicans ever?
I would probably have to say in California, Arizona, and Texas. I think in other areas of the United States, you'll see more Hispanics that would be from Cuba or from Puerto Rico or from South America. So I would think, but there's also to remember that people from Mexico are moving into other states more like north, northeast, so we have to be aware of that, or the south.
I think that that's an excellent point that you're mentioning this, and I may add that I live in New York, and we have seen, even though there is a large concentration of Puerto Ricans mm-hmm. and also Dominicans, that we are seeing pockets of neighborhoods that are comprised
Mexican.
Mostly of Mexicans. And I think that from the healthcare professional, we need to know the differences among the different Hispanic subgroups so that we can provide them with the best counseling. So let's talk a little bit about diabetes and how it has impacted the Mexican community in the United States. And how do Mexicans, and I know that when I say Mexicans, I am talking about, I am really generalizing, and many times that might not be the most efficient way to work. But in general, how do they think, how do you think, Eva, Mexicans view diabetes?
Let me just say one little thing before we go on to that. It's important to remember that the diet in Mexico is very varied, and you cannot make, like you said before, a generalization that say all Mexicans eat this way. It will vary a lot from the part of Mexico they come from. People in the northern part of Mexico tend to use more flour tortillas and corn tortillas and not so much salsa compared to the people in the center of the country. If you have somebody who's coming from the coastal areas, they're probably going to be eating more fish than people from other areas of the country. People in the north of Mexico tend to also eat more beef than other parts of the country. So it's true. It would be important to ask the person that speaks Spanish. You should not assume that they are necessarily Mexican or Mexican-American. You should ask where they're from so that, like you said before, you can do your counseling appropriate to where the person comes from. Now, to answer your questions about how they feel about diabetes, I think many times they think it's not a preventable disease, that it runs in their family, and that no matter what they do, they're going to get it, and that it's kind of like a God-given disease and there's nothing they can do. And important to remember that once they think that you're going to give them insulin, they think this is the end of the world. So it's important for us to explain to them that insulin is not the end of the world, that sometimes using insulin is a good thing because we can control glucose better than sometimes with oral medications.
Great. Eva, I think that you have given us three important pieces of information, and I want the listeners to digest those three key messages. The first one that you mentioned is it's very important to understand that there is no such thing as a Mexican diet any more than there is a European diet or
an American diet.
That regions are crucial when it comes to culinary habits and traditions.
Correct.
And asking someone that is on the coastal region, they might share even some commonalities with other parts of Latin America and even the United States because of their proximity to fish, proximity to other certain foods. So that's essential. And I think that many times I myself might be a little bit hesitant to ask someone, are you from this part of the world? Because I don't want to be insensitive and I do not want to appear that way. So I think that Carmine Kulkarni, a registered dietitian and also from India, had given me a piece of advice that I think I'm going to say it again, and that is to add, the reason that I'm asking where are you from is because I want to be able to provide you with the tips that are very culturally specific to you.
That takes
away from that sensitive part about asking somebody, where are you coming from? The other thing that you had mentioned, which was about diabetes, and that is that the educator must emphasize ways in order to help this Mexican person to view diabetes, if this is the case, to view diabetes as something that they might have some control,
exactly,
either preventing or perhaps managing the condition.
Yes.
And the third, you talked about insulin and the fear of insulin. And I want to ask you, from your experience, what have you used, what methods have you used, some tips that you can share with other healthcare professionals? How do you tackle those two issues? Number one, helping a patient see diabetes not as something that is inevitable. And number two, help somebody to use insulin as a means to better control.
I guess I use myself as an example, because I'm from Mexico and diabetes is very strong in my family. And I always say that my father has diabetes and my sister has diabetes. And for many, many, many years, my father was very resistant to using insulin until he finally had kind of no choice because he had surgery and he had to use the insulin. And he finally saw that using the insulin put his glucose in a much better control. So I don't know that everybody can use that as an example, but maybe they can use a patient as an example without mentioning names because that's illegal. But you can say, I have a patient, A, B, or C, that for many years were resistant, but by using insulin, they were able to prevent or they were able to control their diabetes much better, and the A1C or their glucose levels, you know, went from a number to a certain number. And the other part about making them understand that diabetes is, can be preventable or can be treatable is to I always try to use the idea that if they're in control of their own health and they're able to control what they eat, how they exercise, how they eat, and how they measure their glucose, they're improving their health, and therefore they're able to help their family better. Because a lot of times in the Hispanic culture, whether it's the woman, you're kind of responsible for everybody else and not for yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you're the husband, well, you're the macho, therefore you cannot be sick and everybody has to pay attention to you. But if you are able to put it back into, if they're healthy, they can help their families, sometimes they can see that diabetes can be helped.
Right. Especially, I think I just wanted to underscore
mm-hmm.
the family. That
yes.
many times I find that when you, no matter what, that family, man or woman, wants to be there
exactly.
for his or her child.
Yes.
So by saying you want to do this and be healthy for your children.
And for your family, exactly.
And for your family. That usually is very helpful.
That is very helpful.
Now, let's talk about food, my favorite
sure.
topic.
Thank
and
you.
Diet plays such an important role in health and a bigger role in managing chronic conditions such as diabetes.
Correct.
Now, taking into account a person's schedule, their likes, their dislikes is a major challenge. So let me ask you, when it comes to diabetes, almost every group that I know have foods that are considered healthy and foods that are considered unhealthy or
right.
good for diabetes or bad for diabetes.
Right.
What would be those foods that you think every dietitian or healthcare professional should know when counseling most people that are coming from Mexico?
Probably a big one is cactus or nopales. I mean, I love nopales no matter how you prepare them. They're awesome. But there's actually studies that have shown that they're high in fiber and soluble fiber. Therefore, they do have a hypoglycemic effect. So I would say if they use nopales, tell them to continue using nopales. Other things that some people use is maguey, or sometimes they use aloe vera because they believe that they're for their hypoglycemic effect. So those
now
let me
stop you right there
mm-hmm.
because I was laughing because I had a class yesterday, a
uh-huh.
diabetes group, and someone raised his hand and he said, "What about nopalitos?"
I love them.
And I started laughing because I knew
uh-huh.
that nopales are revered
yep.
by many. And this was someone from Honduras.
Yep.
However, it's so well known, and even in supermarkets now they sell
yes.
nopalina, which is a product that it is touted to lower blood glucose levels. And when you mentioned, yes, there are studies, and I just wanted to say that the amount that has been used in studies was 500 grams of nopal or the cactus has been used to actually, it actually has a hypoglycemic
right.
effect.
Which is like
so,
a pound.
Exactly, which will be about a pound. And then the other part that I wanted you to explain to our audience is, what is maguey? Can you give us a brief description or definition?
Maguey is a fruit that...
Oh, maguey, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. Well, maguey is it's a fruit that has a very big pit and is orange in the inside. And I wanted to say it has to be really good to be really tasty. But I think what people use is they do something with the pit so that they can make a juice out of it, and then they think that that is hypoglycemic.
And this maguey is sold in the United States?
To be honest, I've never seen it in the U.S., but I'm sure that if you go to places online where you sell Hispanic stuff, you might be able to find it.
Interesting. And then they use the pit?
I think, yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Well, me neither. I just learned about it recently when I was looking a little search. I'm like, oh, I like my game. I didn't know that you could use it this way.
Yes. Okay. So then those are considered to be either the healthy foods or the good ones. Good for diabetes.
Correct.
Now, what about the things that are considered to be bad for diabetes you hear your patients from Mexico talk about?
I would say probably the sugar and the candy and the sodas and the, you know, we call it the sugar diabetes. Your blood is sweet. So it's more the pan dulce, you know, the things that we probably also as dietitians correlate with not being that healthy.
Okay. So when things are not good for diabetes or not healthy for diabetes, you would see individuals either trying to curtail the amount, cut back on the amounts. Do you see the opposite happening when they think that a food is good or healthy, that they might think, well,
I can
if
eat all
one
I want.
Cup is good, then three cups is probably better?
I don't think I see that much as that. But I try to just explain to patients or a thing for educators to remember is not everything that they do necessarily has to be negative. Sometimes you need to leave a few of the things that we may perceive as negative in their diet so they can be successful in managing their disease. So if, let's say, you have a patient who really loves to have pan dulce and you know that it's really high in calories and fat and saturated fat, but you can convince them to maybe that by having a small piece within their meal plan, is going to allow them to follow their meal plan in a better way than taking them all away. It's working those little things into their diet so they can be successful at managing their own diet.
Great. And just to define for our non-Mexican listeners, can you define pan dulce or bread that is sweet?
It's bread that is sweet, and the varieties are very, very extensive. So when somebody tells you pan dulce, you kind of have to ask a little bit more what type it is. There's some things that are called conchas that have like a powdered, it's not powdered sugar, but it's like thick sugar on top of it. Then you have orejas that I think in English they're like the elephant ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have different sizes, so you have to add the size. And you have things that would be like muffins. They have things that are like croissants. Sometimes donuts can be a pan dulce. So don't assume that they're all created equal, but you can think
and that they all have the same calories and carbohydrates.
Exactly, but that they all tend to be higher in carbohydrate and higher in fat than a normal type of bread.
Okay. Now, Eva, let me ask you something about
acculturation. Sure.
And acculturation can have both positive and negative effects on our diet as we come to this country. What would you say, both on the positive and the negative side of acculturation, what do you see as changes as families migrate and they become established? What are the positive dietary changes and the not-so-positive dietary changes?
What is important to remember about acculturation is that you cannot assume that somebody who speaks English does not have some remnants of their home diet, but probably that if you have somebody who speaks 100% Spanish and needs somebody to translate, they're probably eating more the way they used to back home, which tends to be, but no, notice I said tends to be, higher in fruits and vegetables, higher in fiber, and probably that's about it. And once they come to this country, we tend to get Americanized, which means that we tend to eat more high fat, more high saturated fat, more cholesterol, lower fiber, less fruits and vegetables. And also, if you're a child of first generation, you probably eat more like the American kids do than your parents. So
you know that you're saying
complex.
Eva, and I was looking into several studies with acculturation with Hispanics, and most of the studies are done with Mexicans because of their large population. And one of the striking acculturation factors was the intake of sweetened beverages by Mexicans as they assimilate
into American culture.
Into the American culture. Has that been your observation or maybe your colleagues' observation as well?
Probably the sweet beverages like the sodas and also a lot of fast food. fast food becomes important, especially when parents, when both parents start to work because they have to make ends meet and they don't have the time to cook like they used to, they rely more on fast food or eating out to feed their families versus cooking at home and using more of the traditional way of eating that they used to do at home.
Okay. What would be your counseling tip, something that has worked to help those parents, especially when as you say, time is so limited?
I would say if they're going to rely on beverages, I would say try to drink more water or make your own beverages with, let's say if you want to make agua de Jamaica, instead of putting sugar, Jamaica would be hibiscus. So instead of putting sugar, you can try to use a sugar-free, either Splenda or any of those natural sugar substitutes. When it comes to eating out, I would try to say that whenever they have time, try to cook more of the traditional foods that they know that they like, let's say like boiled beans or just rice, and try to have things in the freezer so that they don't have to rely on eating out so much. And have fresh fruits and vegetables in season. Don't try to buy things that are not in season. They tend to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So if they buy fruits and veggies in season and try to have those available for their families.
Let's look a little bit because I have always liked the concept of aguas frescas. And,
mm-hmm.
and you had mentioned the agua de Jamaica. And I want our listeners to know a little bit more about what are aguas frescas and how they can help the Mexican families to retain that tradition. Can you expound a little bit on aguas frescas?
Well, like I said, the hibiscus one would be where you take actually the hibiscus flower and you boil it, and by itself it has not really sweet. It has not really sweet at all. So you can add an artificial sweetener. You can also use the same with tamarindo, which is, by itself is not very sweet, and then the same you can add an artificial sweetener. You can also have horchata, in which you have the rice that you let soak in milk or in water, and then the same, you add cinnamon and sugar. So instead of adding the sugar, you can add the artificial sweetener, and you're still having something that you're familiar with without the extra calories from the sugar.
And can they add fat-free or low-fat milk when
yes.
they are making the horchata?
Yes, you can use 1% milk, and you probably have to convince them that it will take some time to sometimes get used to it because they're used to drinking more whole milk than 1% or 2%, and you can go from the 2% to the 1%, and if the non-fat doesn't work, just stick to the 1%.
So in other words, wean yourself off
yes.
from whole milk to 1.
Yes.
Great. Now, if a non-Mexican healthcare professional or
mm-hmm.
someone who's not familiar with Mexican cuisine and taking into consideration that individuals might come from different regions of Mexico,
correct.
So there are going to be regional variations.
Right.
But what would you say if I visited a traditional Mexican home, what would be the basic staple foods that I would most likely find in every home that dietitians and diabetes educators
sure.
or other healthcare professionals should be aware of?
You'll probably find either corn or flour tortillas, depending on where they're coming from. You'll probably find an assortment of different types of beans, black beans, kidney beans, pinto beans, a different variety of chiles, tomatoes, tomatillos. The tomatillo is the green one, which would you make the green salsa. Probably all different types of salsas, whether they were fried salsas or fried or not fried salsas. You probably find some sort of fat, hopefully not lard, but you may find some lard, some oil. I like to make fun of sometimes of myself or of my patients saying that we Mexicans like to fry everything, and if we could fry the lettuce, we would fry the lettuce. So I always like to ask my patients if they have a liter of oil in their pantry, how long does it last? So if they tell me for months and months and months, I know they're doing low fat. If they tell me a week, I know they're frying everything.
And what kind of oil would you say?
Probably vegetable oil.
Vegetable oil. Okay.
I mean, a lot of times it's corn oil or just vegetable oil. And you probably find rice, and you find different types of pastas, fideos or different types of variety of pastas. And fresh fruits and vegetables, hopefully.
Okay. Let
onions
me ask
garlic.
You, when you're saying beans, and you said a different variety of beans, and that's certainly something that we want to encourage because of
correct.
The soluble fiber and also of the impact on the postprandial blood glucose levels as well.
Right.
How are beans prepared traditionally in the Mexican cuisine?
I guess if you have the time, when I was growing up, it was always in the pressure cooker. So that was the fast way. I think nowadays in this country, we probably take them out of the can. So if you're on a low-sodium diet, rinse them very well, or just boil, you know, let them soak overnight and then boil them the next day. And use those to, quote-unquote, make your refried beans. Just mash them and so that they're kind of look like refried beans without having to fry them, really.
Oh, that's a great tip. That's a great tip.
Yeah.
Now, you have been giving us tips throughout making the beverages such as horchata with a lower fat milk and the tips with the beans. Any other food and nutrition tips that would be essential for us to share with someone that comes from Mexico in terms of selection of foods, in terms of preparation, maybe something
sure.
that is culturally acceptable? So many times I said, you know what, instead of this, use this. Instead of that, use
sure.
that.
Well, you can always bargain about the milk, but that's sometimes a hard one. You can try with the sour cream. In Mexico, a lot of times we use the crema fresca, so they can use either less of that or combine it with some plain, non-fat, plain yogurt just to make it a little bit less high in fat. You can choose your battle with the lard. It depends on how often they're using it, because if they're only using it for special occasions, for holidays, it may not be a big issue. If they're using it every day, then you can try to encourage them to use other sources of healthier fats. When it comes to, let's say, they're going to make arroz frito or pasta, or sometimes the sopa de fideos, or you fry the pasta before you add the broth, you're maybe with the rice, you can encourage them to use a very hot pan so that the rice gets a little bit brown, and then you add the broth to that instead of having to fry the rice. And you can do the same with the pasta, and then you season to taste with broth or with onions and garlic and other things that they use for their soup or their rice. The other thing that I would say is try to encourage them themselves be an example to their family and not feel that their diet has to be different than the rest of the family's diet.
Now, typical dishes or traditional dishes, and I was in Guadalajara,
mm-hmm.
And one of the dishes that I savored was pozole.
Oh, I love pozole.
And the pozole is a corn base, which
correct.
Is a different kind of corn.
The hominy.
Right, it's a hominy corn. But one of the things about pozole and corn, of course, is a staple of the Mexican as well as many different parts of Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
And, however, we also, when we ordered the pozole, we noticed that it was also higher in fat than I would have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be a good tip if certain cuts of meats are utilized to make these dishes, what would be a good acceptable substitution that we can suggest?
Well, pozole sometimes, in my house, when I was growing up, it was made with chicken. It was not made with beef or pork. So you can try to make it with chicken.
Okay.
You can try to make the broth the day before and then put it in the put it in the refrigerator so all the fat goes to the top and coagulates and you remove all the extra fat. If you don't have time to do that, usually the fat floats on top of your broth. So you can skim it out with paper towels. And I would just try to use cuts of beef or cuts of pork that are leaner. So usually your select or choice cuts of meat would be better choices.
Okay. Now, many times we give meal plans. Many times dietitians have
mm-hmm.
food frequency questionnaires. And what I find with these meal plans, whether it's something that it's from my pyramid, that many foods that are traditionally consumed in certain cultures are missing from the traditional meal plans.
Yeah.
So if a dietitian had to give a meal plan to someone from Mexico, what would be the key foods that he or she would have to include in that meal plan so that it's a little bit more culturally relevant?
Tortillas, whether they're flour or corn. I would say corn, just corn by itself, beans, sometimes peas, rice, and pasta.
Okay. What about in terms of fruits, vegetables, or even other kinds of meats?
Well, for vegetables, I would say whatever they want because I love them to eat a lot of vegetables. I would inquire about what types of fruit they're eating, and I would encourage them to do fruits within the season. Because once you come to the U.S., you tend to eat the fruits that are kind of in the supermarket unless you're buying them on a specialty place. And then in terms of protein, I think a lot of Mexicans or a lot of people from Mexico, but again, depending on where they're from, they're probably doing beef, pork, fish, and chicken.
Okay. Now, let me ask, and we're coming to an end, but I would love to know about the important holidays. And
sure.
Someone who's not from Mexico would be interested in finding out what are the major holidays and also the foods that are associated
sure.
with those holidays.
Okay. First would be the Quaresma or Lent, in which, you know, it goes from Ash Friday until Good Friday. And usually on Fridays, like any other Catholic, since in Mexico Catholicism is the main religion, they don't eat any meat. They tend to eat fish on those days. Then during December, you have posadas, which would be usually from December 16th to the 24th.
And what are posadas?
Which is, that's what I'm going to tell you. It's usually where they try to replicate when Christ and the Virgin Mary were finding a place for the baby to be born, not Christ, the Father. And they usually sing and they usually have food. So there's usually tamales and there's usually atole, so foods like that. Atole is usually made with cornmeal and milk.
And atole is a beverage.
It's a beverage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, tamales, which can have all different types of things inside. You can have from dulce to with chicken or with beef.
And the tamale will be made of what kind of foods?
Usually from cornmeal. So it would be considered a starch and
okay.
a little bit of protein.
And it will be stuffed or it will not be stuffed?
It's usually stuffed with something. So you have the ones that are sweet tamales, which would have sometimes corn or sometimes a little bit of sweet. The sweet types of, I want to say, like a type of sweet. And then you have the ones that are stuffed with meat. So it can be usually beef or chicken.
Okay.
And then the other one that you have is sometimes Dia de los Reyes or Day of the Kings, in which you have the Rosca de Reyes, which is a round type of bread, and the little child Christ is inside, and whoever gets the baby has to do a party in February where they sell atoles again. I mean,
atoles and
tamales.
So then Three Kings Day, which is
yes.
January 6th,
which is
traditionally,
January 6th. Yes.
And this Rosca is a bread.
Yeah, it's a ring-shaped bread that usually has sugar on top of it.
Mm. And you said
that's
something about that there's something hidden inside of it?
A baby. Usually a little baby Christ or a little
so this
baby.
Is like a plastic, I
which
would
is
imagine?
A plastic baby.
Okay.
And it's supposed to symbolize the baby Christ.
So the person that it's lucky enough
yes.
to get that piece.
Correct.
That person will have to throw a party in February?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, where we eat tamales and atole again.
So
we
it's
like
an
tamales.
Excuse to have a good party.
We always have an excuse to eat, you know that.
That's wonderful. Well, my last question to
sure.
you is for a healthcare professional that mm-hmm. wants to learn more about the different foods of Mexico, different culinary traditions, and everything that is to know about food culture of Mexico. What resources would you recommend?
Well, I'm going to give you a whole list, but you can go to the American Diabetes Association, Latinos and Diabetes. You can do Hispanic Latinos and Diabetes, which is in the NITDK website. You can do probably the DLive. You can do, actually, if you really want to know about food per se, you can go to two websites where you can find different foods from Mexico. One is called amigofoods.com, and the other one is called mexgrocer.com.
Amigofoods.com and mexgrocer.com.
And you can see like a whole variety of different foods, and they actually have also recipes. So you may not per se want to follow the recipes because you may not think they're very healthy, but it will give you an idea of how people are cooking and what type of ingredients they're using, and then you have a better idea of how to counsel your patients.
I think that those two, and I have used them myself,
I've used them too.
Very, very useful,
yes.
Especially when I am not certain what ingredients
exactly
go into most of the foods. And, of course, you can always ask your patient, how do you prepare those foods?
I always ask my patients, believe me. I do not pretend to know that I know everything there is to know about the Mexican diet. So I ask my patients when I don't know what they're talking about.
That's wonderful. Well, today the spotlight was on New Mexico, and our guest was Eva Brzezinski, registered dietitian and a native of Mexico City. Thank you very much, Eva, for this delightful interview.
You're very welcome. Thank you.